Let's talk about Mourner at the Door and the stories. Of course, Mourner at the Door, with all of these very unusual stories, is a continuation of your obvious preoccupation with language. And I don't know if all of the themes are the same, of course, as in your earlier book, Peru, and in Dear Mr. Capote, but certainly the language is very unusual. So I'd like to ask you why you have taken this very unusual approach to writing instead of just, as John Barth would say, just a straight story.
Don, I'm trying to recover the language as it occurs in my heart, in my ear. I have a notion that, to a great extent, the language we use is largely acquired later in life as a means of keeping at bay the world around us. It's a normative language, which very likely does not really have an organic relation to the fiber of our beings. And I'm a fellow who grew up in a family where cliché was the usual means of communication. And indeed, my mother, at whose knee I learned my language, was given to repetitions. So that it seems to me altogether appropriate for me to speak in the terms that you see on display in some of the entries in Mourner at the Door. My feeling is that it's a comparable matter for all of us, that we are all of us, by virtue of our being in the world, driven away from the language which is really innate to us. There's a kind of language in us all, a kind of grammar, which is, by my lights, integral to our biology, almost a genetic disposition that is peculiar to us. And my concern is to find a way to retrieve that language as a way of getting my own being on record.
But our writing is usually done in the form of shorthand. When we write a story, when we write a novel, all of the elements are not included. For example, the transitional elements of walking to a door, walking down the street, or walking over to pick up a telephone, and these sorts of things are usually left out because they're implied. But in your stories, in many of your stories, there are redundancies and repetitions, and it's true that we all talk like that. There's no question. But look, in The Death of Me, I wanted to be amazing. I wanted to be so amazing. I had already been amazing up to a certain point, but I was tired of being at that point. I wanted to go past that point. I wanted to be more amazing than I had been up to that point, and on and on and on.
Yes.
Can't you just say that in a single sentence?
Yes, no, you can't, because you see, Don, my aim is to enclose the reader with the effect of the speech, in much the same way that television encloses all of us, or in the way that the Bible or Freud encloses all of us. My intention is to find a way to come onto the page so that the reader is enshrouded in the ambiance of my voice. I.A. Richards took the position that the mission of communication was to move a certain unit of information from one person to another person. My position is that the mission of communication is to generate desire in those who come to the page to read the work, to create in that person a sensation of being enclosed by a certain kind of atmosphere, which atmosphere promotes in the reader or in the listener a sort of gaze, the way a great painting or a great piece of music might promote in you a gaze, a kind of hummy, buzzy, drifting feeling into which you gleefully escape. I'm trying to use language much in the very same way that a painter or that a musician might use language to promote that buzzy feeling in those who come to my pages, in order to enclose them utterly in the possibility of escaping their immediate terms, escaping their own bodies, and drifting in some kind of meta-language, some kind of meta-place.
But you are so consumed with the language that sometimes, I think you told me a couple of years ago, and this is stuck in my mind, ever since that time, that the story isn't as important to you as the way the story is told. Am I accurate?
Absolutely. I think for grown-ups, all stories have already been heard, and I don't think there are any new stories that we're likely to hear. I think what we are likely to hear, what we need to hear, is the authority, the authenticity of a human heart and its pulsations. And I think what we all crave is that presence, that human presence. I don't think we need any more information to manage our lives. I think what we need is more sensation to manage our lives. So that I'm not really concerned to put before the reader a kind of format in which the news or in which the story is delivered to him. What I really want to put before the reader is the possibility for dream, the possibility for feeling. I think this is what we're chiefly deprived of and what we always crave. I think we don't get enough of it when we're young. I think we never get enough of it. I think we require it terribly in order to fall out of the complication of our own lives, in order to relieve ourselves of our own singularity and drift in some kind of mystery. So, no, I'm really not concerned to set down some kind of consecutive sequence of information that one could call story. I rather imagine that there are no stories that I could invent that haven't been told time and time again with more eloquence than I could ever manage. What I have the prospect of doing that perhaps other writers may not want to do is to put before the reader the very prospect of my heart, what its pulsations peculiarly are. There's no story attached to that at all. It's happening all in a kind of a single place. So that really, if you look at my stories closely, you'll see that the very first sentence is virtually all of the story, and everything that follows is a kind of dilation of that sentence. It's simply evolving that sentence, elongating it, transforming it, until it becomes a kind of global sentence, a kind of global event.
And yet, you're not dismissive of writers who don't write like you, are you? For example, there's a young man, there's a medical student named Ethan Kanan. He doesn't write any way like you at all. And his short stories, which I thought were rather nicely done, are actually little novels.
Kanan is a superb writer. I know the collection, The Empire of Air, and was instantly envious of its excellence. When I saw it, wishing that I might have published it at Knopf, because as you know, I'm an editor at Knopf, wishing too that I might have had entries from it in the Quarterly, because I put out a literary magazine whose business it is to present the work of young writers. Kanan would have made a marvelous contribution to the Quarterly. I am, in producing the Quarterly and in prosecuting my assignment as an editor at Knopf, always publishing writers who are as far from the kind of modalities that I practice as I can find. Heaven knows there's quite enough of me to keep myself busy, and I am scarcely interested in replicating myself in the pages of the Quarterly or at Knopf.
What when you're still teaching, aren't you?
Oh yes, I teach.
What is your basic message to your students?
Tell the truth. Tell the truth. Tell all the truth. Tell every bit of the truth. Reach deep down inside themselves to find the quiddity which is their peculiar truth. You cannot tell the truth with an italicized the. What you can do is tell what you feel, what you know, what you see, what you hear, what you taste, utterly and entirely. And to come to the page with the intention of doing other than that is to come to the page fraudulently, falsely, and uselessly. My notion of the writer is that he is at his best modality a high priest. He delivers the Blessed Sacrament. He puts into the hands of people what it is to be alive, what it is to have a death, what it is to have a life. You can't do that if you cheat. You can't do that if you only tell half the story, as it were. You have to deliver all of yourself. Nothing else will do.
I'm not sure I know exactly what you mean. You say to tell the truth. a writer doesn't have to a fiction writer doesn't have to tell the truth.
Of course not. You're using the truth in the terms that I decry. He doesn't know the truth. He has no possession of the truth. None of us does. What he has only possession of is the validity, the authenticity of what he perceives. And this he is, I think, required to bring to the page, if in fact he is a literary artist. There are persons that, I think the French expression for them is writeners. These are people who coat the page with words, and these words eventually eventuate into some kind of entertainment for persons. And there may be no relation between that activity and telling the truth. There may in fact be. I can't speak to it. I'm not expert in the matter. But I do believe that there's another kind of vocation that a writer might in fact prosecute. And this one is involved with telling the truth, or at least it's involved with authenticity and authority. The authority of your own being. This is all you really have within you to impart. There's nothing else that you have possession of.
That sounds a little bit like somebody was writing an article about chili that I was reading a while ago, and it said it didn't really matter what the chili, how the chili was made, as long as it was made honestly.
Yes, yes.
I couldn't quite figure out what was dishonest chili. Exactly.
Well, if you've spent some time in Texas as I have, I used to live in Pampa, Texas, which is a small town outside of Amarillo. And
you were at radio there.
Yes, well, I was indeed, a little station called KPDN before I came to New Haven and then to New York. But I can tell you this, I've participated in many chili cookouts, and I can tell you that among chili heads, there is generally the position taken that certain kinds of ways of doing chili are simply dishonest ways of doing chili. I can't speak to it further than that on this occasion, but I can tell you that certainly is the general position adopted by most persons who do practice chili cooking. I think what I'm trying to say is this. I don't believe that I have anything to offer the world save the configuration of myself. That which I have acquired, which is beyond myself, has been acquired more ably and can be rendered more ably by so many persons. I think it would take an awful lot of cheek for me to come to the page believing that I could surpass or supplant others in the giving of that quiddity. What I believe I can always claim to do ably enough is to get my own peculiar configuration on the page. Now, to adopt the analogy of chili, one's not required to put his ladle into somebody else's pot and take a taste. I'm certainly not putting a gun to anyone's head and insisting he try the chili that I make.
No, you're saying be yourself as a writer, aren't you?
Absolutely. Be yourself as a human being, I think.
Problem is that so many of us receive our impressions from what other people write, and they become our teachers and our leaders, and so we tend to imitate them.
Receive text, secondary text. I think the great tragedy of most persons who try to take up pencil and paper is that they fancy that the way to do so is to do it either the way a fourth grade teacher has instructed them to do, or secondary school teacher, or Saul Bellow. The general notion is this is how it is done, and I will, in order to prosecute this kind of activity, do it as others have done it, rather than to understand what seems to me to be the blatant truth, that the only way to do it is to do it as it has not been done, and the only way you can do that is to do it as you would normally do it.
Well, let's talk just briefly about a couple of the individual stories in Mourner at the Door. Mr. Goldbaum, tell me about that story.
Of all the stories in the book, I think you've picked the one which has the most considerable relation to the deepest place in me. It's a story which arises out of the death of my father. And I'm willing to stand on the statement that every word in that story, every word that is reported is true, even though the story is really in its particularities imagined. It's a story that appeared in what some people claim to be, and I would second the opinion, the most distinguished literary magazine in America. That would be Richard Poirier's Raritan, published over at Rutgers University. But when it did appear in various anthologies thereafter, it created quite a stir, in as much as it was felt that the story was shocking in its terms, shocking in its language, shocking in its components, and so on. My own feeling is that of all the stories in this book, and I believe there are 27 of them, it is the one story that I will withdraw no part of. It's the one story that I feel myself increasingly convinced of the validity of as I reread it. And I do reread these stories because I'm continually looking for ways of improving them, recasting them, revising them. So that Mr. Goldbaum, which is set in Miami Beach and which is a story about the a grisly reality of a death in Miami Beach, grows in magnitude in my own heart as I contemplate its statements, because every day of my life since the death of my father, which was 2 years ago, is a day that I contemplate his death. I begin increasingly to see the meaning of that death for me in the meaning of that story.
The one of the stories that bothered me the most, I think, was the one called Shit. What possessed you to write Shit?
Well, like all the stories in this book, it arises out of experience, and this was an experience which took place in the very terms that are stated in the story. Indeed, the history I brought to that experience, that of my own natural motions with respect to what I eat and what I pass out of my body, are all absolutely authentic. Indeed, I was trying to make a statement about how stories are made, and I was trying to make a statement about how art contrives to create a bridge between us and those who come to it, so that in a kind of way, we save the lives of those who come to it. It's a story about making art and how art can be contrived out of virtually anything, indeed out of the very waste of our own bodies.
Well, I would assume that even the heartbreak of psoriasis is not going to escape your attention at some point in literary terms, is it?
No, I suffer psoriasis, as you know, Don, and I've written about this in an earlier collection of stories called What I Know So Far. I note with some pleasure the fact that a writer as great as John Updike has, and who also suffers from psoriasis, has given much poetry to the condition that we suffer in common with respect to a piece he produced in the New Yorker magazine some years ago, and which he, I understand, will reproduce in a book of essays he's about to publish. I've never written about psoriasis with the usefulness that John Updike has, but certainly I have, in the little I have written about psoriasis, come to the page with as much vehemence in the matter since I have been afflicted with this skin condition since the age of 7, and now age 54, am even more alert to what psoriasis can do to disable me, and as much as I only 8 weeks ago was hospitalized for 5 days with psoriasis. I expect that's not the last time this will happen. It is on my mind a great deal, but as I am only too willing to say, psoriasis is scarcely to be considered, even in its most horrid terms, a kind of consequential matter in a life when we are in a world where thousands are crying out with every kind of human indignity and pain every minute of the day.
Well, we're almost out of time, Gordon, but obviously we're going to have to talk a little bit about the Quarterly, which is now 1 year old. Tell me how did the magazine come into being?
I've been enormously frustrated with the absence of the prospect of doing at Knopf what I was able to do when I was at Esquire, and that is to put on to the attention of a wide audience the work of new writers, so that eventually I was able to persuade the key persons at Random House to let me try this magazine. And now we have before you the evidence of what that effort has brought to bear. It's a magazine which is vigorously and shamelessly concerned to publish those pieces of fiction and poetry and occasional writing that occur to my attention to be virtually unwelcome everywhere else. These are without, with few exceptions, writers who are young, sometimes as young as 18, 19. In fact, I think we have one contributor who's as young as 16, whose work I think is significant and whose action at the edge of the national literature I expect will become increasingly known.
Yes, these are unfamiliar names to me, but I noticed in the initial issue of the Quarterly, there we had a number of well-known people: Harvey Shapiro, Amy Hempel, Jane Smiley.
Yes,
there's a new book that Knopf just published, I believe, and so there were quite a few well-known names mixed up with people that I didn't know. But in the spring issue, almost all of these are new names to me. What these are people who submit the stories to you, and you sift through them. And
the Quarterly is receiving on the order of 150 to 250 manuscripts of prose and poetry a day, and one simply does what he can to make his way through that number of manuscripts, keeping his heart and his mind wide open for what may be special. The task is seems to those who don't do it an insurmountable one, but to me it's a one I welcome with enormous eagerness every day. It's a terrific pleasure to wade and wade and wade and wade through all this language in an effort to find at the very bottom of it something shining and radiant. And it is my.
You go home with a very heavy briefcase.
I carry two. I carry two great big satchels around New York, and not infrequently do the bulk of my reading while waiting for dermatologists and so forth. Yes, I read all the time. I read all the time. I don't sleep very much. I'm probably logging no more than an hour and a half, 2.5 hours of sleep a night, but I don't seem to be too terribly damaged by it yet.
2.5 hours of sleep?
Something like that, yes. I read a lot, and I have to read a lot to keep current with what I must keep current with. I think what happens is this, Don. I think that the exhilaration of turning up that which I expect no one else has turned up, finding some piece of writing from someone that no one else knows about, so excites me, so drives me, that I keep at this task without fatigue.
Does the Quarterly pay for its entries?
Yes, it does. It doesn't pay robustly, but I think with a certain honorable intention, the rates will vary from person to person, depending on some kind of reckoning I can make of how great the need is. It is not in any wise to be viewed as competitive with other magazines in this respect, but I think it makes a good show of its intentions to be honorable.
The Quarterly, can it be purchased at most newsstands?
It's at newsstands and also principally at bookstores. It's being distributed by Vintage Books, and like the Vintage Contemporaries, it will appear wherever Vintage Contemporaries do, and that means that all the better bookstores, not only throughout the USA, but it's also available in Europe. I have people writing me from France and Italy and England and Switzerland, all saying they see it with great regularity. So it's round. It's generally around, and I expect that as the issues unfold, I've closed 10 of them so far, and 5 have been published, that as these issues unfold, I think it has an increasing opportunity of putting copies out there virtually all around the reading world.
No advertising.
No advertising and no statements of a biographical kind about the contributors. My aim is to waste no space with anything that might be turned over to a poem or turned over to a story. I was given 256 pages per issue. Some of the issues have indeed been larger than that, but as a rule, I'm given 256 pages, and I'm always about 65 pages over. So I'm certainly not going to give over one page to anything which isn't absolutely pertinent to what I think the national literature could use, which is all the energy it could get.
Well, the Quarterly is certainly a welcome and needed addition. Is it tough to be published today as it was, as compared to it was when you were with Esquire in the days of the general magazines?
Well, I can't really speak to it accurately. I would say it is harder. I think it is harder to view the experience of my students who try these magazines, such as Esquire and The New Yorker and Harper's and Atlantic and so on. I'm guessing that there is somewhat less hospitality for serious fiction now than there had been. Certainly there are fewer places among the national magazines. One of my most extraordinary students, a fellow for whom I have the highest expectations, Mark Richard, has had 2 stories recently taken by Esquire magazine. Another young man that I'm connected with, Rick Bass, whose work has appeared in the Quarterly as well, has had fiction taken by Esquire and by, I think it is, I can't think who the second magazine is, which it is, but they're exceptional cases. I think for the most part that the young writers are finding their reception almost entirely either at the publishing houses or with the small presses. I don't think that the national magazines are quite as willing to stretch themselves now as they might have been back in the 70s. I don't know what the reasons for this would be.
Well, they only publish 2 or 3 stories anyway. I mean, it's just a drop in the bucket.
Precisely. The numbers are so small. A friend of mine recently did a statistical experiment for me, setting forth the hard numbers of fiction published against fiction probably produced in this country, if one does a reckoning with all the schools and writers' workshops and what these magazines, by and large, report receiving in the way of unsolicited manuscripts. The numbers are really quite astounding to consider. So that, as you rightly report, such a tiny, tiny amount really ever reaches publication anyway. Of course, it's to be claimed that such a tiny, tiny amount deserves to reach publication. I don't quarrel with that at all. I think that the quarrel I would have is which part is receiving publication? Which tiny part? What indeed are the stories and the poetry that constitute that tiny part? My own claim would be that it's essentially the wrong kind.
Well, Gordon Lish, it's always a pleasure talking to you. I hope we'll continue to do this year after year, assuming that there's a CBS. Assuming there's a CBS and a BookBeat on it. So I hope we continue to be able to talk about art and literature and words. And it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
You're very kind, Don. I hope the Quarterly lasts as long as CBS.